And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another week, another amazing week. Do you remember a TV show many years ago called That Was the Week That Was? We should actually do something on this show, you know, a feature maybe, kind of featuring the weirdest thing that's happened in the previous week. The problem is that we would spend the entire show talking about weird things because life is getting increasingly weird. This morning will not be weird. It'll be amazing. It'll be beyond amazing, as you're going to hear and see. First of all, I want to kind of give you a tease for tomorrow morning. If you go to othersideofmidnight.com, which, of course, when you listen to the show, even on any device that you're carrying, or it's in your backpack, or it's sitting on your dashboard, or wherever you're listening to us and looking at our radio with pictures, it's always useful to go to the website because there's cool stuff there. Tonight, at the top, link number one, is my link, and it has to do with this stunning news that came out yesterday. Jimmy Carter at Sunday School, as he's been doing for the last several months as part of his kind of open witnessing, he has revealed that he has decided now to cancel the remaining treatments in his cancer protocol because apparently all evidence of cancer from his latest MRI scan, a two-hour MRI, that obviously was a full-body scan, can find no sign of the cancer. And this is very confusing because a few weeks ago there was a blip that said that his cancer had returned and all that. Well, we're not going to spend time tonight doing this because I'm going to take time for my guests, but tomorrow night is Open Hailing Frequencies, and we're going to spend, you know, some time with Robin going into the background, the medical background of what's going on, and, you know, signal from noise, truth from non-truth. And the reason this is important, of course, is that Jimmy Carter is kind of like a role model. Former president, around the world, working with all kinds of people to try to make their lives better. At 91, he has more energy than some people I know that were in the Republican presidential campaign. That was a joke, folks. So tomorrow night, we're going to talk about Jimmy and what's going on and what it portends for the rest of us. Tonight, I want to talk about dowsing. Dowsing is fascinating because it's one of the litany of activities that humans do that isn't acknowledged by mainstream science as having any validity. Which means, of course, it's one of the things that we're really intrigued with because when mainstream science says something isn't impossible or not legitimate or not credible, well, to kind of paraphrase my old friend Arthur Clarke, when a distinguished scientist says something is impossible, when a distinguished scientist says something is possible, he usually underestimates how rapidly it will become the norm. And when that same elderly scientist says something is impossible, he undoubtedly will be proven wrong within, you know, years or decades or whatever, because that's the progress of science. So tonight we're going to talk about dowsing. We're going to talk about it in connection with our favorite subject here, which is hyperdimensional torsion field physics. And we're going to get into some of the mechanisms of how it might work, and obviously the empirical evidence that demonstrates that it does work. So without further ado, let me go to my guest of this morning. Maria Wheatley is our guest for the next 2 hours. Maria is a second-generation dowser who was taught by European master dowsers and Chinese geomants. And we will discuss what a geomant is. Maria is a leading authority on geodetic earth energies and ley lines, and yes, we will define these terms as we move through the morning. Miss Witt is an accomplished author of books on sacred sites and dowsing. She's continued her late father's dowsing research into esoteric design canons of prehistoric sites, which are, of course, all over Britain, including druidic ceremonial enclosures and the Knights Templars, churches, and cathedrals. Oh, she doused cathedrals, because that's one of the things I want to talk about, is measuring the energies around cathedrals. She has studied Neolithic Britain and Bronze Age prehistory with the University of Bath, and alongside other professionals, she's combined her knowledge of archaeology and earth energies with state-of-the-art equipment to locate, detect, and interpret the hidden frequencies that the Earth emits. Her findings challenge our understanding of sacred sites. Maria, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, as my grandmother used to say, to be had. So when I read your bio, the thing that struck me was there's not a bit of the interesting background in it, which is how the heck did you get into this? So let's start at the beginning.
Sure, yeah. I got into dowsing and looking at ancient sites for their energies, you know, like ley lines and earth energies that you mentioned in the intro, through my late father, who was he was a master dowser. And it's kind of, dowsing has been in my family for quite some time. So I inherited the skill and the enthusiasm to look at ancient sites through the art of dowsing, which anyone can do, by the way. Dowsing is a very, very simple skill.
Okay, for those who are listening to us on Pango Pango, what is dowsing and how does it work?
Well, dowsing uses a dowsing instrument, and that could be something like a pendulum or it could be L-rods. And these dowsing instruments can pick up hidden energies. That could be underground water. That could be something quite, you know, mundane, like pipes, for instance. Or it could be something like a high frequency emitted by the earth. A dowsing instrument can detect anything, really. It allows you to detect the invisible and make it visible.
Okay, now you said there are several ways, several instrumentalities that are used in dowsing. You mentioned a pendulum, which I presume is something you hold in your hands with a little kind of a string or a chain or something with a weight on the end of it. And how does it respond if it's responding correctly?
That's right. If you use a pendulum, which can be anything on a piece of string, like you said, you can set up your yes and no responses by asking the pendulum to give you a response. And for example, yes could be a clockwise motion indicating yes or found, and a no could be an anti-clockwise motion. So that's called information dowsing. You set up yes or no responses, and then you can ask the pendulum anything that you want. Is there underground water here? Is my house affected by a negative gridline or geopathic stress, for example? You can start to ask a multitude of questions to your dowsing instrument to determine what's happening in your home or at a sacred site, for example.
Okay, and you mentioned another instrument, an L rod. What is that?
An L rod is literally like L shape. It's normally made of metal these days. A good L rod could be made of copper and nickel, for example, because copper is a really good conductor and it can pick up on energy quite fast. And it's literally an L shape, and you just hold them in your hands and you can walk forward. A traditional dowsing rod for water diviners would have been from a hazel or a willow tree, and it's a Y shape. Or a V-shape. And the original V-shape type dowsing rod was considered the dowsing rod of Gaia. It was considered a feminine dowsing rod. And the Y-shape rod, where you would hold the Y bit in your two hands and have a kind of point forward, that would be considered a male dowsing rod.
Okay. Now, dowsing rods I've used. Sorry about that. A friend of mine made some for me many, many, many years ago, which consisted of kind of a short pair of copper pipes, very, very small, and then bent coat hangers into the form of an L. And you put the short end of the coat hanger in the copper pipe, and you hold the two copper pipes in both hands, and the bent coat hangers at right angles kind of wobble around in front of you as you walk across a field or a lawn or the driveway looking for, you know, where are the sewer lines, where are the water lines, that kind of thing. Is that a kind of a modern update of the original L-shaped rods?
Well, you can really make L rods out of anything. I mean, bent coat hangers, or you can get you can buy them from, you know, new age shops now and online shops. It's really an extension of your sixth sense. That's what dowsing is.
See, that was my next question. When you say you ask these questions, kind of like a computer, binary, yes, no, yes, no. Who are you asking?
Yes, a lot of people feel that you're asking your higher self or universal consciousness to enhancing your sixth sense. And it's like a muscle reaction when your muscles react and a rod will swing yes or no. So really we're tuning into our higher selves and the universal consciousness, which has all the answers to everything. And time isn't seen as linear in that dimension. So you can tap into that wondrous and infinite source of wisdom.
So if dowsing has been in your family for a long time, how far back do you trace it? And when you say that anybody can do it, apparently there are certain families where the talent is more pronounced, which is why we're talking to you tonight. So what's the difference between someone who is really an adept at this and someone, like a lot of people listening, obviously, who might be intrigued and might want to kind of dabble with it and see if they have any abilities? In other words, how do you find out if you really can do this?
Well, the easiest way is literally like you described yourself. Get some coat hangers, and most of us have those in our wardrobes.
Well, you know everybody has them, and they multiply at night in the closet. You know that, right?
There we go. There's no excuse then, is there? And literally bend them at a right angle and walk around your home, and you will find that, you know, the rods will react to something that you find beneath the ground. It could be a sewer pipe, it could be a grid line. And then really the art of dowsing is just learning what types of energies prevail and are the commonest, if you like, and you build up a rapport of what you can find and douse. For example, German dowsers and European dowsers are very au fait with dowsing grid lines, because certain grid lines can conduct what's called geopathic stress. That's negative earth energy. So they would decode somebody's home and house. I mean, I do that myself. And that's what they look at in Europe, because there was a study done of over 8,700 people looking into geopathic stress, negative earth energies. And it was found that a third of all hospital admissions was down to geopathic stress.
A third of the hospital what?
Emissions.
Emissions.
Admissions.
What's
going into hospital? A lot of
Admissions. Admissions. Okay.
Admissions. Okay. Yes. Sorry, that's my accent.
I'll get used to it.
And it was found that, a third of all of those people were admitted due to geopathic stress. The further studies then said take a person away from geopathic stress and the body can self-heal faster.
So wait a minute, you're telling me if my house is built on a geopathic stress line in the crust of the earth, I will get ill?
Yes, long-term exposure to that. I mean, that would be year after year after year. That wouldn't be a short-term exposure. Yes, long-term exposure will weaken your immune system and make you prone to what's in your DNA bank of, you know, disease. So it could be arthritis for one person. It could be cancer for another. In fact, in Germany, they called them cancer houses because they found that the geopathic stress would induce, because it breaks the immune system down, the DNA cancer in your family that you've inherited. And what they also found, and this is very, very intriguing, that it didn't matter what type of therapy that you had to cure yourself if you're still living above the geopathic stress. I mean, for example, that could be acupuncture. You could go down the complementary therapy route, or you could go down the orthodox route of, you know, radiotherapy we have in the UK and chemotherapy. The body still takes longer to self-heal. Take the body away from the geopathic stress and the therapy really does kick in.
Okay, so you mentioned a study. Who did this study and where was it published?
The study was done by Dr. Banis and it
Dr.
was published.
Banis. Does he have a first name?
I could look that up for you.
And when was it done?
That was done in 1997.
Okay, and it was done in Germany. 8,000 people, you said?
about 8,000 people were part of that study to look into the geopathic stress. You see, in some parts of Germany and Austria, if you buy a house, you look for a certificate that says, is it prone to geopathic stress? And if it is prone to geopathic stress, what path have they taken to reduce that geopathic stress? Because there's certain devices that you can buy, and you can have your house doused and checked to see if it has geopathic stress or not. So in Europe, it's quite common to talk about geopathic stress.
So you're telling me that if I was to go to Europe and Robin and I were to buy a house somewhere in England or in Germany or somewhere else, that as part of the due diligence on the house, there's actually an official document that says the house is located over a stress line or a stress region?
Yes. And
sanctioned by the government?
I don't know if that's sanctioned by the government or not, but it's because dowsing in Europe is much more accepted. It's not something that is, you know, you need to look into it from a scientific point of view, like in the UK, actually, and maybe that's the USA group mindset, but it's really kind of common. So I think that it's up to the house seller, the vendor, to do that. But I think it should catch on worldwide pretty soon, the more knowledge that we have.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, I mean, there are – we have over here in the United States, we have certain what they're called cancer clusters, and no modern scientific approach has been able to figure out. They're looking at radiation, leakage of toxins, you know, ancient landfills, all the usual stuff, and yet the clusters still remain. They find no anomalies, but people are still getting sick. So you're saying that possibly the one thing we're not looking at over here is these geopathic terrestrial stress energies in the planet itself, because we don't think this stuff works.
Yes, and for example, one of the most commonest causes of geopathic stress is a grid system. Imagine that the Earth has a fishnet put over her, and there's lots of little squares, yeah? And the intersection point of some of those squares of the Curry grid, or the Curry net, as it's commonly called.
The Curry grid, where did the name come from?
Dr. Manfred Curry discovered the grid in the 1950s.
Oh.
So, and what he noticed was where he was taking blood samples affected the blood. So he then looked into the environ a little bit more and realized where you have the crossing point of this grid system, which is generated by the Earth itself. Just throwing out lines, roughly in Europe, they're about 3.5 meters distance, you know, from one another. And the crossing points that are toxic are about 7 meters apart. So you don't want your bed above that. That's long-term exposure. If you work from home in front of a PC and you're sat hour after hour, you don't want to be above that type of geopathic stress Curry grid line.
Which means if your computer is downstairs and your bedroom is upstairs, and the office is located beneath your bedroom, should turn off all your electronics before you go to bed?
Yes, because the grid lines can conduct electromagnetic energy. So these days, with a lot of Wi-Fi, a lot of master dowsers suggest that they will start conducting man-made signals as well as geopathic stress.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Okay, let's go back to your background. Your dad was a master dowser. How does one become a master dowser? Who recognizes the talent? In other words, it almost sounds like a trade union where dowsers all kind of get together and they, you know, have meetings and they have, you know, clubs and they have dinners and then they have award ceremonies like the Oscars and then they award. So how did your dad become a master dowser?
He was taught by a European master dowser. because he expressed an interest in it. Because again, you know, a lot of the good knowledge does come from Europe or China. So he got taught various different skills from European master dowsers. And today, I mean, in America, you have the American Dowsing Society, or you have independent dowsing schools such as myself. You have a lot of choice these days, you know, with online colleges. I myself run an online college, esotericcollege.com, and the Avebury Experience. .co.uk. So you can choose. And I always say to people, if you do want to take up dowsing professionally, just feel who's right for you, feel who, where you would like to learn from. And like I say, there's a lot of professional dowsing societies these days that Google will bring up in a few seconds for you to see and see what suits you.
Okay, so your dad was a master dowser, and as you're growing up, did he actually do this on a contract basis? Was it started as a hobby for him? Did he become a professional? In other words, I'm completely ignorant of the world of dowsing, so kind of fill us in. How does one become a master dowser?
Yes, well, for my late father, he was given by a chap called John Martineau, all the unpublished surveys of another master dowser called Guy Underwood, who looked into earth energies and ley lines, for example. So he studied that independently and became a world authority on that type of dowsing, which is about sort of ley lines and particular types of earth energies. And he studied that for about, you know, 30 or so years. And I myself have studied that for many, many decades. So dowsing really is about learning different types of energies from grid lines to earth energies to the, you can douse the aura, for example, you can douse chakras, you can douse for health remedies. And it's about building up a rapport, which you can do independently, or you can study under a master dowser yourself to learn those skills. And it's really, really easy. Everyone and anyone can douse. I think in the ancient world, for example, we could sense these energies. Maybe we didn't need dowsing rods as such, but we could sense the different types of energies. And maybe as well, even our visual perception, our hearing perception, which we'll look into later with different types of energy, I think they could hear earth energies.
Hmm. You know, this sounds like something straight out of Harry Potter, don't you?
Well, it might do to some people, but there is evidence for that. I mean, there really is. We're starting to understand what earth energy is and how it can affect people.
So you keep saying everybody can do this, but frankly, among all the people I know, and I know a lot of people, you're probably one of the few dowsers that I know. So most people don't even experiment or try. Does it run in families? Is it linked to DNA? Does it really help that your dad was a dowser to help in terms of your genetic, you know, inheritance?
I mean, possibly that did help, but I mean, I have taught hundreds of people how to douse, how to check their homes for geopathic stress, how to douse for all sorts of different earth energies at, you know, wondrous sacred sites across the world. So that's why I know anyone and everyone can do it. Take a little kid. Say I'm out with a tour group at Avebury and I'm showing about how to douse for megalithic energy. That's the energy that is emitted by standing stones that we'll discuss later. Get a little kid, you know, that has no baggage whatsoever, doesn't really mind if the rod will fail or not. They get the energy first time. And if you have just that little bit of confidence to hold a dowsing rod, you will soon, within 5 or 10 minutes, learn how to douse for grid lines and all different sorts of energies. It's very easy to do. All you need is a little bit of instruction, and that's it.
Do you find there's any difference between older people and very young people? In other words, are young people, because they don't have preconceptions, oh, this can't work, this is crazy, this is woo-woo, this is, you know, new age. Is there a kind of like, well, of course I can do it, and they just go ahead and do it, compared to adults who learn through all their lives, oh, this stuff is just nonsense, of course I can't do it?
I agree. I think children are great because they just get on with doing it with no questions. But I think if you take an average person with an average open mind, then the ability to douse can start to grow. And it's a bit like learning your old-fashioned times table. You have to say them a couple of times to really know them instantly. Dowsing is the same. Practice something a couple of times, and it will become very soon second nature.
So when you were growing up as the daughter of a younger dowser, of older, do you have family? Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have brothers and sisters, but they weren't so interested in dowsing or the esoteric arts as I was. And I myself have a daughter, and she can douse, and she likes to do that from time to time.
Because I'm just wondering, you obviously imitated and followed the pattern of your dad, but the rest of your brothers and sisters, their interests went in different directions. So that says to me that there's more than just the genetic connection. There's got to be something else that makes you decide, yes, I'm intrigued, I want to follow this.
Yes, I from a young age, I had an interest in astrology and tarot as well. So I've always kind of wanted to understand mysteries, and I've always been fascinated by the ancient world, like Stonehenge and other types of megalithic buildings. So I've always kind of been drawn to find out more about the ancient world.
Well, it certainly surrounds you where you live. By the way, where exactly are you?
I'm based in a beautiful 12th century town called Marlborough, which is not that far from Avebury. It's literally about 5 or 10 minutes down the road. And Stonehenge is probably about 30, 35 minutes away. So I'm kind of in the hub of a megalithic wonderland.
Oh, I know exactly where you are because Robin and I went there. I had a speaking engagement three years ago. And then I went and I measured with our technology, which we'll get into much later, Stonehenge and Avebury. And Marlborough was a very nice place because they had the most amazing restaurant we found up a back street. And we wound up sitting around with a whole bunch of people, just, you know, patrons, discussing the monuments. And there was a mayor there, and there was a town councilman, and, you know, just patrons. And we had a heck of a time in Marlborough.
Yeah, that's my hometown.
Okay, so we have a couple of minutes here at the bottom of the hour. Do you find that there's a difference between ancient dowsing, meaning from the 50s and 60s and 70s, to the dowsing now? Because, and there's a reason for that question.
Sorry, can you repeat that, Richard?
Is there a difference between older dowsing eras, like the 50s? You talked about a study that was done by a certain doctor in the 50s, and dowsing now. Has there been any change that you're aware of over decades?
Yes. Dowsing from pre-1980, for example, used different techniques to what modern dowsers do now. For example, there was a master dowser called Tom Lethbridge, and he devised a method called long cord pendulum dowsing, where you'd find the rate of something, and the rate of something could be the rate for silver, the rate for gold, the rate for human consciousness, and it would be so many inches on a pendulum. And you wouldn't have to think about anything. The pendulum would find that because it would know the rates of whatever it is you're detecting. Then in about the 1990s, it became more fashionable for your mind to ask for something in information dowsing. So you just ask a short cord pendulum or an L rod. Is there, for example, any gold within this vicinity? Is there any underground water within this house, etc., etc.? So the human mind became more and more involved with dowsing over the years. And that's the major change that I have personally noted, being involved in dowsing for a few decades now.
Interesting. Well, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley. We're discussing dowsing, perhaps the most interesting and intimate of torsion field physics manifestations, as we're going to talk about in a little while. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning is Maria Wheatley, and we're discussing dowsing, an invisible energy that somehow is picked up by human beings, is transmitted through a technology that you hold, except it's not really a technology. It's kind of like one of those tubes in one of those old Star Trek episodes where Spock looked at the tube and he said, "Captain, it's just a hollow tube." So, Maria, how do you use dowsing? What got you into the archaeology? Because obviously we're going to be talking about Stonehenge and Avebury and Standing Stones. And why don't we start with defining what the heck is a ley line? I mean, when I heard that term for the first time a long time ago, because I was a good little Catholic boy, I thought, okay, we have clergy and we have lay people. Are ley lines because ordinary people, in other words, what is a ley line?
Ley lines were rediscovered in the UK in about the 1920s to the 1930s by a chap called Alfred Watkins. And he made the term ley or ley line. And he noted that when there's five or more sites located in a straight line, you know, really in a linear fashion, that is a ley line. So you need the minimum of five sites.
And what does the ley, L-E-Y, mean?
Line. So in the UK...
Oh, so it's really like a redundancy. It's a line. Lay means a line.
Yeah, that's why in the USA, people say lay lines. They're saying line. But over in the UK, we just say lay. But, I mean, it doesn't matter. Because
it's always a little thing. You know, there are things in life that always bug you. I always wondered, where did the term ley line come? Now you've solved a many decades-old mystery. Thank you.
Yeah, so Alfred Watkins, he looked into a lot of the topographical alignments that were linear with ancient sites aligned upon them.
You mean various ruins and ancient sites and all that laid out across the landscape in a line?
Standing of, you know, going up to high places like high hills and looking across. And then he started to survey the land itself to look for the ancient sites that were lined upon it. But going back, in to the best of my knowledge, the first mention of leys and earth energies came from Queen Elizabeth I's, a magician and astrologer called Dr. John Dee.
Oh, infamous Dr. John Dee. I wonder when we get to him.
Very infamous. And he was the first person to quote about leys. He called them the immortal linear beams, the immortal straight beams, and the meandering earth energies that gave the magician or the occultist the power in their words and in their works. And that's a quote from Dr. John Dee. So I personally believe that throughout the aristocracy and throughout, you know, the time from the Elizabethan time of the 14th, 15th century onwards, leys have always been known to a certain group of people. And it was just that visionary moment of Alfred Watkins in the 1920s and 30s that brought the word ley to the public consciousness.
Well, isn't it true that in Europe, particularly in Britain, a lot of relatively new churches, you know, even hundreds of years old, are built on these ancient sacred sites that are on leys? So the guys who built the churches must have known there was an energy there that they were tapping into as part of the reason for constructing the church there.
Yes, and that certainly is the case. The Masons that built a lot of the churches from the 12th century onwards, they were very familiar with how to locate a church and make its access line literally sit wonderfully on the ley. And depending on who the church is dedicated to, let's say, for example, Mary, or let's say St. George, would give you an instant recognition whether that ley was predominantly male or female by the church dedicated the name of the saint to it.
Now, when you say male or female, and those are very human-centric ideas, how does a force of nature have a gender?
Yes, that's a good point. For many centuries now, It started a long time ago in France. You have the French Colour School of Dowson, and they would look at the frequency of a lay on earth energy current. They would look to the colour, and they would look to see if it was called magnetic or electric. Depending on how a pendulum or an L-wad would react to that, would decree whether it was male or female, or fast flowing or slow flowing. So they have a kind of Dowson device that you can use to ascertain a lot of information about an earth energy line or current, and it's a high frequency color Dowson.
So the lays have individual properties, energetic properties, and they respond to, they make instruments respond differently so they can be differentiated. You can tell a male line from a female, but the appellation of male and female is just kind of done to indicate that they're different, but it doesn't really tell us how different or what they really do, unless maybe it does. I mean, if you have males and females dowsing, do they interact differently with the same lay?
No. The energy of lays conduct energy very fast. And again, if we look to the science behind that founded and understood earth energies, then we look to ancient China and the ancient art of feng shui. And it's always been, and this was all documented from 2250 BC onwards. They wrote down what they knew about their geomancy system, meaning earth energy system. Mm-hmm. And it was found that lays, for example, are mainly very fast flowing. And
now, when you say fast flowing, what do you mean? I mean, what is flowing? I'm standing in a field. I've got waving grain or rape or wheat or whatever, and I've got my dowsing rods. How do I tell that a particular line of energy across the Earth's surface is fast or slow? When you say fast or slow, is it moving along the line or is it moving sideways at right angles to the line?
A lot of people feel that it flows along the line. It's a conductor. It's an energy. A lay is an energy conductor. It will conduct energy in a straight line. Now, that would be considered to be, in ancient China, detrimental for long-term exposure to live above because it conducts sha qi. Anything in a straight line will make energy flow very fast. That's why in ancient China, their roofs are always horseshoe shape because it will make the qi energy of the universe flow a little.
Skype dropped out.
Flat
again.
On the top.
Yeah, can you repeat that, Maria, because your Skype dropped out.
Sorry. Yes, in ancient China, a straight line conducts energy really fast, and it's called sha qi. So that's not good to live above for long-term exposure. That's why in ancient China, their houses are all designed with a slight horseshoe shape in the middle, because the energy of the universe, qi, likes to flow more slower through a horseshoe shape. That's why ancient Chinese and modern-day Chinese feng shui masters don't like Western roofs because they're very flat and they will conduct sha qi. Now, in the ground, if we project that model into the ground, then a lay is a fast flowing conductor of energy, electromagnetic energy through the ground and slightly above the ground. So we see lays as not always directly in the earth itself. It is in the earth, but it's out of the earth as well. It's slightly just above the surface of the earth.
Okay, going back to what we were talking about in the first segment, you said that there was a German study based on these grid lines and that you were talking about geopathic stress and all that. And I didn't get to ask you, are these grid lines as part of that study, were they oriented in any particular direction, north, south, east, west?
Yes, the Curry net, or the Curry grid as it's commonly called, is orientated northwest, southeast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it's not aligned with the Earth's spin axis, it's tilted.
It's tilted.
Well, that's weird. Do we know how much?
Yes, at a 45-degree angle. So if you've got north in front of you, and then, you know, you put your arms out at a right angle, in between that 90 degrees, that 45-degree angle, the curry neck comes in and forms its grid. So you could douse your house across the northwest sector, and you will find, in all probability, a line. And then you just have to determine if that line is, you know, positive or negative in terms of the energy it's emitting. Russian scientists looked into grid systems, and they found that they start to deplete the air of its negative ion content and make it more highly charged with positive ions, which actually aren't very good for you. It's the negative ions that are good for us. So, and they also notice at the crossing point of grid systems, you have a more gamma radiation being emitted. And gamma radiation isn't good for your body either.
How do you get gamma radiation in a low radiation environment? That's kind of curious.
That was a Russian study looking into particular types of grid systems, not the curry net, but there's more than one grid system that can influence our physical, mental, and emotional bodies.
Okay, so we have the curry net, which you said is a grid, but it's 45 degrees off north, east, southwest. Mm. How do ley lines relate to the curry grid?
Well, a ley line can cross a curry net, for example.
But wait, there are two separate things then, right?
They're two separate things.
Oh, see, this is crucial. So define the difference, please.
Yeah. In the UK, we see grid systems to be totally separate to leys, because a ley can be a short distance. It could go for just 2 to 3 miles and terminate in the ground at a standing stone, for example, or in a church. Or they can be global. They can go wrap themselves right round the earth, where they then become a circle, the straight line.
Like an old great circle route.
Yeah. And in fact, the ancient druids of England said there's 12 mighty circles that encircle the globe.
12? So they see
12 mighty circles.
That's interesting. 12 is very hyperdimensional. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So you could have short distance leys or global leys, or you could have a ley, you know, traveling for like 20, 30 miles or going right up the spine of England or across England and on to France and other places. And the grid systems discovered by Dr. Manfred Curry and Dr. Hartmann, they're Pacific sizes. So every, for example, the curry nets.
I'm sorry, do you mean Hartmann or Whitman?
Hartmann.
Okay.
Dr. Hartmann discovered a global grid system that is orientated north, south, east, west, and it is spaced roughly 2.5 meters. It's that was always believed to be relatively harmless. But a lot of dowsers over the past 10 years think that too can conduct man-made electromagnetic frequencies. So that can be detrimental.
And we've been filling the environment with all kinds of electromagnetic noise, pollution.
We call it e-smog, electromagnetic smog, because if you could see it, if you were in your home and you could visually see electromagnetic smog, e-smog, you wouldn't want to breathe it in. If we visualize that as like smoke, but because we can't see it, we become unaware of it.
Okay, so let's get a little more specific. When did you kind of get intrigued with this whole field, which is very esoteric? Again, it sounds an awful lot like something from Harry Potter. When did you connect it to the archaeology surrounding you? Because obviously that's where we're going with this.
Yes, that was in about the 1990s when my late father was looking into how Earth energies relate to ancient sites like Stonehenge, Avebury, and Silbury Hill, and places like Karnak and Malta, how these Earth energies were integrated into the foundation plans of prehistoric monuments from the Neolithic and from the Bronze Age, because they do follow certain patterns. And it's almost like the ancients looked for particular types of earth energies and sited their monuments upon them.
You said earlier that you felt that maybe the ancients, and we'll use that, overall term, were more sensitive, that they were able to detect, smell, maybe even hear when they crossed lines, or the interaction of lines with man-made structures and all that. Is it also possible, which is kind of what my other question was getting at in terms of changes over your lifetime in dowsing, is it possible that the background energies, the physics itself, is changing? So it used to be much higher, and now it's lower, so we need more enhancements to pick up what normally almost anybody could pick up, which is why the ancient peoples were able to feel where these lines and crossings were, and so put sacred sites on those particular locations.
Yes, I feel there's a disconnect now. You know, we have less contact with the earth. We have less contact with nature. We have a lot of light pollution. And we have a lot of, you know, e-smog that we were talking about earlier. And I think all of that combines to making a disconnect with the land upon which we live. I mean, for example, old manor houses in the UK, they were always sited where sheep or animals lie. And there's a very old saying.
Where sheep or animals do what?
Lie down.
Oh, there's okay.
There's an old saying here, build your farmstead where the sheep doth lie, because animals naturally know what's good for them. Yeah, they naturally, instinctively know.
Well, they must be sensitive.
They are sensitive. They follow certain energy lines, for example. And that's why wildebeest, for example, follow what's called a track line in terms of earth energy. That's energy that's emitted in a particular pattern above the ground. And it will make your muscles quite strong and quite supple. So you could walk for a long, 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 long time on a track line. That's why certain animals follow them and migrate them. And over here, Richard, I'm sure that you could remember the Ridgeway. It's a very ancient road.
Oh, yes.
Yep. So I just described that to the listeners. It's an ancient old road that courses across high ground in the UK, which does link some ancient sites. And it's ancient. It goes back to Mesolithic times, about 10,000 BC. And that's located above a track line. So if you walk those natural tracks that were probably trodden out by animals to begin with, you won't tire as much. So all the old roads in the UK were aligned upon this type of energy system.
If you go to othersideofmidnight.com, everybody, you know the drill by now, and then in the upper right-hand corner, you click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to Maria's page tonight. And Maria has graced us with some really interesting images, including a map. Why don't you kind of describe number four, Maria, because I think there's a line there. And I had an email tonight from a friend of ours who's a steady listener to the show. He works part-time on an oil rig somewhere in the North Sea. And when he's home, he says, I'm at the end of the Michael line. So what is the Michael line and the belly? Is it the Bellings line?
Bellinas
line. And where are they and what do we know about them?
That's right. That's picture number four. And what we see is
so we
the
click on it and it makes it bigger.
Yep. And what we can see is going west to east across England, you have what's called the Michael Line. It's 300 miles long across that landmass. And Avebury Henge, which is the world's largest stone circle, is aligned in the exact center of that lane. Now, that was discovered.
Wait, back up and tell me that again, please.
The Michael Line is 300 miles long.
I see that.
And Avebury Henge, which contains the world's largest stone circle, is at the exact center of that ley line.
Okay, so if you follow the Michael Line, walking from west to east, when you get halfway across it, there's Avebury.
There's Avebury in the center of that lay. Now, that lay was also orientated towards the Beltane, that's the May the 1st sunrise, and the Samhain, that's the November 1st Halloween sunset. So it's an astronomical lay that becomes highly charged when around those two points of the year, which were very sacred times in the ancient pagan calendar.
So let me make sure I understand this now. As the Earth goes around the sun till the 23.5 degrees, if you looked at the eastern sunrise, it goes, you know, north in the summer and south in the winter and back north in the next cycle, etc., as it's moving along the horizon, which is geometrically created by the tilt of the Earth to its orbit as we go around the sun, when the sun aligns with the Michael line, you say that that lay is energized by that geometric astronomical alignment?
It becomes stronger.
Fascinating.
With that solar alignment. I mean, it was more accurate, but we have what's called the precession of the equinoxes, so things are a little bit out now. But if you imagine in pristine condition in 3000 BC, when those monuments were being aligned upon that solar lay,
of course,
it would become highly charged. And that's because it was noted by somebody called Paul McCartney, not of the Beatles fame. I hasten to add, not of the Beatles fame.
Really? It's not that Paul McCartney.
That Paul McCartney. This is a different Paul McCartney. Now, what he discovered in the 1980s was all stone circles in the UK are sited only about a mile and a half away from a fault line. That doesn't have to be a big fault line. It can be a small fault line. Now, when the sun or the moon crosses the horizon line, it's a natural geological fact. It creates like a pull on the Earth. Imagine like a wave coming at dawn and sunset. When anything crosses the horizon line, it makes a sheer force on the ground that energizes stones or buildings sited upon it. It's called the shear force, S-H-E-E-R. And put a ley line on top of that.
No, wait. Shear like in... See, to me, shearing means slipping or sliding, like I'm trying to think of an analogy here. But this is not spelled S-H-E-A-R, it's S-H-E-E-R?
Yep.
And what does it mean? What does shear mean, a shear line mean?
It shear force. It means that a fault line reacts to when the sun or the moon cross the horizon line, and it generates a kind of, you know, like a little bit of like a wave, like at the seaside, you know, when waves pull in and go out. And if a megalith is sighted upon that, it's thought that that becomes slightly more charged with electromagnetic energy, which may explain why some ancient sites are orientated to an astronomical celestial event. So clearly to ancient man, they were utilizing some kind of energy force generated by these astronomical events. And it was John Michell in the 1960s that discovered the St. Michael ley line.
A view over Atlantis.
A new view of Atlantis. That's exactly correct. And he really looked into the alignments upon it. Then in the 1980s, John Michell, who discovered this line, said to two dowsers called Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, and I knew Hamish, the late Hamish Miller. It was John Michell that said, look, guys, why don't you douse this Michael line and see what you get? And what they got was two meandering currents that entwine the ley line.
Like a vortex.
Yeah, they twist them round. You know, like,
but it's horizontal.
Yes, it's horizontal, but the energy currents, as they're called, earth energy currents, entwine that lay in a Caduceus style manner. You know, like the symbol of the Caduceus, where you get a straight line in two circumference?
I was just going to say, it sounds like DNA, energy DNA, like spirals laid out across the landscape, disappearing over one horizon and the other horizon in a line.
Exactly, Richard. That is it in a nutshell. And that's a great analogy that you have given your listeners. So what Hamish discovered, one energy line that was entwining the St. Michael line looked for high places, you know, like Glastonbury Tor, and that's a really big hill in the UK.
Oh, I know it well. Stunning.
I know you would.
It's almost like a streamlined ship. If you look at it from the top down, from an aerial view, and it's got this peculiar monument right on the very tip top.
That's right. It's got a tower dedicated to St. Michael. So what Hamish
was this, by the way, the Michael line, is that the St. Michael?
They called it the Michael line because there was a lot of churches dedicated to St. Michael upon that line. And same with the earth current that entwines it. It goes to high places, and they considered it to be an energetic line, so they considered that male. And they discovered that, roughly speaking, every 10 kilometres, every 8 miles or so, there was a church dedicated to St. George or St. Michael upon that earth current. So they called the earth current the Michael current. When it came to the other energy current that entwines it, it went to more lower valley places like springs and churches alike, and some your monuments. But it seemed to be a little bit less energetic. And they noticed that, you know, every sort of 8 miles or so, and sometimes even 5 miles apart, there were churches dedicated to Mary Magdalene or the Virgin Mary aligned upon them. So they called that the Mary line, the Mary current. So you have these two currents entwining the ley line. It's a ley system.
Of course,
Yeah.
Now, how do we get the Bolinas line? We got about 2 minutes till the top of the hour here.
The Bolinas line was discovered in the 70s by a chap called Guy Phillips. And Gary Biltcliffe and Caroline Hoare, who studied that for many years, I think it's about 10, 15 years, they too realized that had two currents entwining it in the DNA that we discussed earlier, so the analogy or the caduceus. And they called those currents the Bolinas current and the Elland current. So these are ley systems. They're alive. They're alive with Gaia's energies entwining them. They're not just a straight line on a piece of paper.
Before we have to leave this segment, do these energies on these lines change with time of day, with time of year, with, you mentioned the precessional cycle, so if we have a long set of data, like hundreds of years or a couple hundred years, do they change on longer timescales too? In other words, when you say they're alive, you mean the energies are pulsing and changing and they're not constant.
They do seem to become highly energized to the solar event they're aligned to.
Okay.
So for Beltane and Samhain around about Halloween, November the 1st, May 1st, the St. Michael line and the currents entwine it seem to be more energetic. They seem to be more alive, for example. And at the time, we're coming up to an eclipse pretty soon, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
On the 9th. Now, all dowsers have noticed in Europe and England, that's when all the earth currents, all of the leys, they become quiet. You can't find them in the land. It's like they become invisible time of the eclipses.
Let's pick it up there, because I want to follow this, because we've got some measurements that are very correlative. My guest this morning is Marie Wheatley. We're discussing the idea of ley lines, of an enormous, you know, geometric grid on the Earth's surface, which somehow seems to mirror astronomical orientations, to change with seasons, and as she just informed us, during a solar eclipse, they go quiet. What in the world would cause that? This is one of our listeners who sent us some music tonight, a guy named Lolo Don. This is called The Bus Going Home, and oddly enough, it's about human DNA. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. He's driving the bus going home.
Live in a body, interact with the world. A canyon so deep between a boy and a girl. Our hearts can fail us, our thoughts can go wrong. But the pressure to provoke me, it keeps pushing us on. We can try to ignore it, we can keep our eyes closed, but our DNA is driving the bus going home.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. Temperature here in the Land of Enchantment, which is a long way from where Ramia is tonight, is kind of in the upper 30s. They're telling us that winter may return. Okay, let's go back to Radio with Pictures. Remember, othersideofmidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. Click on that. We have a whole bunch of interesting images now of ancient sites. Why don't we get into, how they interact with these grids, these lines, these energy currents, and, B, how you got into being interested in measuring them.
Sure. Well, picture number one, for example, is a long barrow called Bella Snap.
Okay, you're going to have to define long barrow.
Yep. A long barrow is a Neolithic monument, dated to Orthodox dating to about 3,800 BC. That's the Neolithic, meaning the New Stone Age, monument. So that was constructed about that time. But that said, archaeologists date a monument by carbon that they find within the monument.
Yeah, the radiocarbon technique.
Yeah. So the skulls and long bones were placed by the Neolithic peoples, it's believed, into burial chambers. You can see a burial chamber in picture number two. It's a small opening. And these bones were placed into them. But the monument itself could be much, much older than that. And the Neolithic reused the monument in about 3,800 BC. So I personally suspect that the monument is much older than that. And it could possibly date as far back as, you know, about 10,000 BC.
See, now this is interesting because in our work with the torsion field HD model, we find that radioactive decay, in other words, the decay of carbon-14 with a half-life of normally a little under 6,000 years, if you subject a decaying nucleid, which is going to radioactively, you know, break apart, decay, if you expose it to torsion field energy, you change the decay rate. Does the sighting of these ancient monuments on these lines of energy affect the decay rate of carbon-14 of the sacred site, giving you a totally error-prone reading if you're using modern science, which doesn't acknowledge any of this yet, and try to get a date because the date has been changed because of the energy in the environment?
That's a really, really good point that you've raised. And I think, yes, that needs to be looked into.
We have all kinds of wonderful experimental data going all the way from our work to the Russians. So one of the things I would like to do is to measure the decay rate on ley lines versus decay rates not on ley lines and see if they're different. I bet no one's ever thought to even do that.
No, and other earth energies besides as well that are very strong, like the earth currents I was talking about as well, you know, earth energies and lays itself. And that is a wonderful point that you have raised, and one that I really do think should be looked into, because I think you've raised a very relevant point there. So
when we come to England, Maria, hint, hint, can we do that? Can you get us into some of these places? Could we measure, for instance, the torsion field effects that I'm measuring with our current instrumentation? And could we, in fact, bring a Geiger counter and other radiation equipment to actually try to measure in a brief period of time where we get some statistics? What if the actual decay, the splitting apart of carbon-14, is different in these locations than other places?
Yes, and we could look at specific types of earth energy and the relationship between lays and some very energetic patterns. I was with Rodney Hale, and we did some Geiger count
readings. Now, who was Rodney Hale?
Rodney Hale worked with Paul Devereux, who's a very famous Earth Mysteries expert.
Okay.
From the 70s to the 80s, they did what's called the Dragon Project. And the Dragon Project in the 70s and 80s looked into ancient sites for radiation anomalies, for lays and things like that. But they were mainly focusing on the ancient site rather than the earth energies. And Rodney was a part of that team way back. Rodney joined me about 10 years ago, and we looked into radiation levels throughout ancient sites. And what we noticed was at the center of a monument close to Avebury Henge called the Sanctuary, right at the center of the sanctuary. And today, the sanctuary was destroyed in the 1800s, and all that's left is concrete marker stones telling you where the standing stones once stood. That's the sad fact. But nonetheless, this shows that it was the ground upon which the ancients analyzed the energies, because even with the stones long gone, right at the center of that monument called the sanctuary, you have incredibly incredibly high gamma radiation levels, you walk outside of the stone circle, away from the concrete marker, and make a control area, and it dips down to the normal background radiation levels. So, you know, the ancients were looking for all different types of energy.
Gamma radiation is incredibly high penetrating ionizing radiation. It's electromagnetic. It's not a particle. It's kind of like a very, 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 very short light wave, but it can be lethal. If you have it in any sufficient intensity, it'll kill you. That's what, you know, being exposed to radiation from a nuclear blast does. It kills people through gamma radiation even before they're dead from heat and all the other stuff. So what is generating gamma rays in the middle of an ancient sacred site that doesn't even exist anymore, technically?
I know. It's truly fascinating.
And where is this study published? Because if you could send me some links after the show, I want to follow up on this because I'm serious about coming over and you know,
that's
kind of hanging
work,
around with you.
I'll send you the book,
excellent.
Which we published that in, Richard, because we've looked to different areas. I mean, another very famous ancient site is called the Rollright Stones in Oxfordshire. It's a complete stone circle. Unlike Avebury and Stonehenge, they're ruinous, so they don't retain their circular shape anymore, yeah, because stones have been missing and they've been pulled down over the centuries, shockingly so. But when you go to Rollright in Oxfordshire or Castle Rigg in Cumbria, they are stone circles that retain their circular shape. Now, once a stone circle retains its circular shape, it starts to generate even more energy around the outside, which we could measure, for example. And then you always get a stone circle, one stone offset. And I can show you that at Avebury, I can show you that at Stonehenge, and I could show you that at any stone circle. And that's where the energy is being guided, that if you imagine it spinning around the outside of a stone circle, and then it shoots off in a direction, that's a high energy electromagnetic beam that's being shooted off. Now, in the Rollright environs, again, there are high levels of gamma radiation. What were our ancient ancestors
when you say high levels, how high is
Well, it was higher than the background.
That's more comforting because I really don't want to go and expose myself to gamma radiation if we don't have to.
No, and I can send you the reports that we've done of that.
Excellent.
But my point is, it's about the ancients were looking for particular types of energy. I mean, maybe they had the technology to, you know, do something with that type of gamma radiation that made it less harmful. I mean, I really don't know. But what I do
or know the gamma radiation is a side effect of the other energetic things the circles are doing. Now, this gets to a really intriguing point. Mainstream archaeologists now, because of the work of, and I can't remember his name at the moment, in the 50s, the guy who first kind of figured out the astronomical relationship of Stonehenge to sunrise, sunset, and all that.
Gerald Hawkins.
Hawkins. The science crowd has basically now said, okay, these ancient monuments had some kind of astronomical relationships. But it seems to me that from listening to you, they actually were using the standing stones and dragging them in from all different parts of the planet, sometimes hundreds of miles away, to create a technology to shape and shift and control and move this invisible energy.
Yes, that's what I think that the ancients were doing. I mean, for example, at Stonehenge alone, you've got two main types of stone. One called sarsen stone, that's the big stones that you can clear.
Skype again.
Smaller stones on the inside are called the blue stones, and they came about 130 miles away from the Preseli Mountains in Wales. But they are three times more magnetic than any other stone in the UK.
So the ancient architects were specifically choosing with incredible precision their materials, even if they had to logistically move the stones hundreds of miles, because of the properties, and the properties then combined at the right location with the right energy flowing for the right effect, which was what? What were they trying to do?
I think they were generating an energy system that we see the vestiges of today.
You mean like a planetary grid system?
Yeah.
See, and that gets us to the work of Karl Monk. the guy that I was going to mention that you haven't heard of, and boy, do I need to send you his stuff, because Carl Monk totally independently has figured out that all these ancient sites, not only in England, but all over the planet, at one time were connected, were talking to each other through these energy systems, these geophysical energies, the hyperdimensional field, and the different cultures use different modalities, but basically all had the same idea that they were using and manipulating and utilizing these energies.
Yes, I mean, for example, the way I see, I agree with that. There's particular types of
Skype again.
Deep underground water generated by Gaia herself. That's an esoteric water. Water is not just collected from, you know, the water that falls from the sky. And that generates a very strong spiral pattern. It's what all water diviners would look for if you want a long-term supply of water. Now, an allay generates electromagnetic energy. Now, if the listeners look at picture number three.
Okay, let's go to Other Side of Midnight, Radio with Pictures, picture three. Oh, that's weird. What in the world is that?
Well, now, this is how I think they would pass in the energy around.
I say, so what's the black thing we're looking at?
Yeah, what you're looking at is, imagine now that you've got a ley line, just like the picture next door to that, picture number four, mm-hmm. or a spiral pattern of underground water, or an earth current like we discussed wraps around the ley line, and you put a standing stone into that energy system.
Okay, yeah? So the black thing is a standing stone.
It's a standing stone, and if you put that standing stone into that energy system, standing stones behave, it's found, in a particular manner. Now, a stone is rooted into the ground, so that picture doesn't show you the stone beneath the ground.
Underneath the ground. But you're saying, like an iceberg, the really important part is not the stone you see, but the stone you don't see.
Well, beneath the ground, you have two more of those bands. Can you see you've got one, two, three, four, five mm-hmm. bands above ground? Mm-hmm. And if you imagine that spirals around the stone, and you've got two bands below the ground.
For a total of seven.
A total of seven. You could call them chakras. You could, you know,
well,
you could call them what you like.
Seven's also very hyperdimensional / tetrahedral / torsion.
Yes, yes, and so it is. It's a very sacred seven. And what we found was by using some equipment with Rodney Hale that can detect any electromagnetic energy. It was my late father that said all standing stones have these energy bands. That's what he called them, energy bands. Mm. Yeah. 1 to 5 above the ground. And I wanted Rodney to, you know, say it's not just dowsing that can do this. What is actually going on? And he made some equipment that could pick up on electromagnetic frequencies. And he found that at the bands and at the bands alone, they were generating an electromagnetic signal, a very strong one compared to the bits in between. And what we've always said with band number two, that's produced an electromagnetic signal that passes an energy beam of energy to the next standing stone beside it.
It's so like, they're communicating with each other.
They're communicating. And my late father called that crosstalk.
Ah.
Crosstalk communication between stones. They're all behaving in a particular manner.
He must now, have hung out with some radio guys. Because crosstalk sure. is the term you use.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. And band number four, this is quite intriguing because it was discovered after many experiments that is a long-term transmission band. So instead of like band number two is localized, you know, crosstalk, as we've just called it, band number four is sending a signal to the next stone circle.
Oh, my God.
So it's now the network isn't isolated, yeah? So the network has a localized energy field, but a long-distance energy field as well.
This is like an ancient Neolithic internet.
It's Wi-Fi. No wires. So this is very, very, you know, sophisticated because they were looking for these energy patterns and it's like plugging the standing stone into that energy system. because on an internal level, a standing stone's crystal lattice structure is very similar to a modern-day semiconductor chip made in Silicon Valley. There are similarities that have been noticed between the two. I think our ancient ancestors were prehistoric physicists who could generate and maintain a free energy network. And what we're seeing now are the vestiges of that.
Yeah.
So I agree with Carl's work, but I see it through the standing stones and certain structures sited upon that energy system that can then start to conduct it even further.
So if we have a bunch of bad guys who basically want to keep us from knowing that all this ancient, you know, non-EM, because the EM is a side effect in our model, it's not primary to the energy. The energy is what you can't see with current technology, unless you're really, really clever. If you have folks that want to destroy this system, the way you do it is by destroying the sites, taking stones out of the circle, breaking the circle, breaking circles in the larger pattern. So you basically destroy the ancient global Wi-Fi system to basically keep us from knowing it works or benefiting from how it works.
Exactly. One thing that I point out to people that I take to Stonehenge, and I give tours, you know, around ancient sites here in the UK, which you can look at.
Boy, I wish we'd known you a couple, 3 years ago, because Robin and I came over and we measured a bunch of the stuff, including Stonehenge. And wait till I tell you what we found at Stonehenge. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear that, Richard. Excuse me. But one thing you notice next time you go to Stonehenge, that part of that monument was dismantled.
Yes.
Because some of the lintels, that's the one that stood above the two stones.
Like the cross beam on the top of the door.
Yeah. They have fallen down, but in pristine condition. They haven't. Some of them haven't broken up. It's like they've been taken down and placed on the ground.
Ah,
now, if they had
de-energized, if they'd fallen, they would have cracked. They would have split.
They would have cracked. They would have split. And I can point out quite a few of those. Now, another strange thing about Stonehenge, it was excavated in the 1950s by Professor Richard Atkinson. He was the main excavator, and even today with people like Michael Parker Pearson, who's an archaeologist for the Riverside Project, they have never done the amount of work that Richard Atkinson did. Now, if Richard Atkinson in the 50s found an anomaly stone, that's a stone that he didn't fit into Stonehenge, they buried it. So you have
Backup. Didn't fit in terms of what? Material, composition, geometry, placement?
Yep, the geometry placement, which is, you know, again, the Richard Atkinson model with the horseshoe in the middle, that's become a little bit old. They now think it's an oval stone circle at the center, for example, and not a horseshoe shape.
More like an elliptical orbit.
More like exactly an elliptical orbit. It's not a horseshoe shape. Richard Atkinson, that was a model. Everybody believes that model. So archaeologists today are questioning that 1950s moderns think, well, hey, you've got standing stone evidence of stone standing there that have long gone, that don't fit into that model. Now, there's one stone, which if I ever do take you to Stonehenge, I'm going to show you this stone because it's a blue stone. It's from that inner horseshoe or oval shape, as we now think of it.
Which is from Wales, 200 and some miles away.
Exactly. They were highly polished, very highly polished as well. And it's got a groove going right the way down it. Now, beneath that, buried by Colonel Hawley in the 1920s and not excavated properly in the 1950s by Richard Atkinson, is another stone beneath it that would have fitted perfectly in between that. They were making two blue stones slide together as one. But that's hidden under the ground.
Wow, this is so cool and now it's time to, you know, we're going to talk a little much more about Stonehenge in a few minutes, but when Robin and I came over, one of the key things I wanted to do, because I spent days and days measuring Avebury, and I found real differences. Silbury Hill gave me stunning readings, even though it's just a pile of junk. It's a pile of junk arranged in a certain geometry, and it is active. It's got stunning energetic properties for the instruments that I was using. Took it to Stonehenge. It's just about sunset. and it's been raining, and it's not happy to measure, you know, Stonehenge in the rain. You have to be very, very determined, you know, to get a reading, to stand there for 20, 30 minutes in the rain. And the guards, of course, they're very, very uptight, and they wouldn't let me step over the rope and go to the center of the monument. I had to stay on that little walkway, like 20 or 30 feet away from the center. And yeah. What we found was the Accutron went nuts in a certain position, and then we went around to where the heelstone is, nothing. So I found that it was directional, whatever was happening. And so now let me tell you what we're measuring. The Accutron technology is basically a tuning fork, and the tuning fork is electronically kept at a certain frequency, 360 cycles per second. The energies of these ancient sacred sites I found, from pyramids to standing stones, changes the frequency of the tuning fork. And the only way it can do that is by changing the inertia, the mass of the tuning fork, so it vibrates differently. So these energies not only interact biologically with people, they actually are changing motion. They change the mass. They make things lighter or heavier. Now, we're talking 0.00001%, right? Very fine sensitivity. But they're actually changing the physical mass properties of moving matter in their vicinity, all with zero electromagnetic input.
Yes, that's truly fascinating. And, you know, Stonehenge, the way that it's been erected, the place where it's been erected. I mean, if you take away all the standing stones there, and you look to the type of earth energies that are there, you have an immense body of underground water. And also what people forget about Stonehenge, Richard, because we see it through how we look at it today, it had an immense henge bank around it. And a henge bank is a ditch and a bank, a big chalk wall. Now, that chalk wall was 10 foot high that surrounded Stonehenge. It's long gone now. So whatever was happening on the inside of Stonehenge, the average person could not see what was going on. It was made to look like an enclosure, maybe just for a few people, maybe for, you know, a crowd of people, but nonetheless, that was a very secretive place.
Fascinating. Now, Hawkins felt that those ditches were artificial horizons, that if you're looking at these things as astronomical markers, that you needed a flat horizon to reproduce, you know, rising and setting and all that. But you're telling me that they were built to screen optically what was going on inside the sacred site during a ceremony from the great unwashed... and that may have been literally in those days, outside the circle. I have a feeling that there's more to it than that. I think there had to be something in the energetics about creating an artificial barrier with water inside, with the stones focusing the energies inside that.
Well, exactly. I mean, it had a huge henge wall of chalk block.
Chalk is important because chalk is calcium carbonate, which is limestone, which interacts vigorously with the torsion field.
Exactly, and it carries a
and in fact, the whole plane. I'm sorry. The whole plane of Salisbury is built on chalk.
Yes, and most of southern Britain is actually where you find a lot of the ancient sites. They are on limestone or chalk. It's limestone heading up from Oxfordshire. But you're right, Nick. It's a natural generator of, you know, an electrical current, if you will. And authors like John Burke pointed out where you have an opening in the henge. We call it a causeway. It's how you walk in through so you don't fall down the ditch. Mm-hmm. So it's how you walk across it. That guides the electromagnetic signal around the monument itself, heading towards the center. And he thought if you put grain or seed there, it would enhance its ability to grow and become a healthier plant,
example. Gosh, Maria, wait till you hear this story. We've got about a minute to the bottom of the hour. When Rob and I went down to Chichen Itza to measure the Kukulcan Khan Pyramid, we also went to a place called Tikal, which I'm sure you've seen. And we had a genuine Mayan shaman as our guide.
Wow.
And I'm showing him the technology. I'm showing the computer screen and the wiggles and the squiggles as the Accutron is changing its inertia depending upon the energies. And we're sitting on the top of one of these pyramids and our feet are dangling over the edge, which for somebody who used to have a great fear of heights is kind of intriguing, personally. And he's looking at the screen and says, oh, my God, my grandmother used to tell me that that's what these were doing, and you're showing it. And then, wow. then he told me the story at Tikal that they have a whole square, like a ceremonial square, between two huge pyramids, these huge, tall, very steep pyramids. You've seen them in the movies and on TV, and they were actually in Star Wars. That was one of the sites that George Lucas, you know, put his Rebel Alliance in the middle of. One, I think it was Tikal. Anyway, so between them, there is a set of apartments on one side, and he said at certain times of the year, the peasants from 40, 50 miles away would bring all their seeds to this square between these huge pyramids, which I measured as being very energetic to the Accutron, and they would keep them there for like a week with ceremony and dances and drink and all this stuff. Then they would take the seeds home and they would plant them. And the whole idea was that exposure to those pyramids energized the seeds.
Mm, exactly. And because at the center of Stonehenge...
Well, I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We are at the bottom of the hour. I'm getting good at this. My clock is on the other wall behind me. This is new music from one of our many listeners, Lee Culprit. So when you say he's the culprit, this is Lee Culprit. Called Subsea Journey. Subsea meaning light, of course. My guest this morning, Maria Wheatley, we're discussing dowsing, energies, torsion, and what comes next. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. We are back on the other side of midnight. Maria, we only have about half an hour left, and we have too much time to get to everything. We call this in the business a blivet, and I will not explain a blivet. I'll do it off the air. Anyway, let's go back to radio with pictures. We have pictures of landscape, number five, and then we have a bunch of skulls. I want to get to the skulls, but tell us about number five first.
Well, number five is sort of an aerial view of part of the Stonehenge environs. And this was a very large monument that was sighted in front of Stonehenge.
Well, this is the Cursus.
This is Cursus Monument, which was 1.75 miles long and, again, made of huge chalk block with no entrance to get into the monument itself. Now,
it's just a bunch of piled up earth / chalk.
A chalk block, so that looks like brick. So it's chalk block, yeah? Rather than just a pile of earth. Should have been gleaming chalk white, really, really thick chalk block that survived right up until, you know, about the 1700s, and then it was ploughed to oblivion.
Oh, what a shame.
Unfortunately. So this is the trace of it. But these were huge monuments created by the Neolithic with no entrances. And what we discovered as well through using a Geiger counter, like we were talking about earlier, Richard, was at the near center of this monument. Again, there seems to be a difference in background radiation to what's being, at that place. It's like a hot spot of gamma radiation. So this is a huge, huge monument that is often overlooked. And the largest Cursus monument in the UK is in a place called Dorset. That's towards our south coast, south of Stonehenge. And that was 7 miles long.
Oh, my God. So they were harnessing, amplifying by building big, big, big stuff made out of calcium carbonate, limestone. They were building huge solid-state amplifiers for this energy.
I think they were, for sure. And the remnants is still there.
But to do what? What was the purpose? What was the point?
That is a very intriguing point about the Cursus Monument, because that's pre-Stonehenge. So these monuments, they're very elongated in shape, and as we'll discuss in a moment, that there were certain people living in the Stonehenge that had more like elongated skulls, and they were the ones creating these elongated type of monuments in the ancient landscape. So this is one of the earliest monuments in the European landscape.
It looks like they'd marked out a portion of a line, a lay.
There is a part of a lay going east to west. I mean, roughly this is orientated east-west. Like I say, it's, you know, about sort of 150 yards in front of Stonehenge, but it predates Stonehenge. So, yeah, part of it does follow a lay, but not all in part like you would one would think.
Okay, so the skulls. What in the world are the skulls doing on our Radio with Pictures page?
Well, it was, you see, a lot of the information that comes out about Stonehenge, and I've mentioned the professor, was from the 1960s. You had Gerald Hawkins, which we've discussed, that looked into the astronomical alignments of Stonehenge. And preceding him in the 50s, you had Richard Atkinson. Now, everything we see about Stonehenge is through their eyes. What I wanted to do in my research was go back to source. Where were they getting their information from? Where were the earliest archaeological study reports? And go back to the get-go, so to speak. And the get-go period was the Victorian archaeologists. We call them antiquarians. I mean, you had William Stukeley from about 1724. Then in the 1800s, you had some moneyed people, aristocracy, that would look into the barrows. But they were starting to make reports about what they were finding. So the earliest reports of the long barrows, and we can see in picture number two on your pictures page, a very long, elongated long barrow monument there. They were being constructed by people that had elongated type skulls. And this came out from the early archaeological reports. In fact, long before people like Richard Atkinson, there was a phrase made, long barrows, long skulls, round barrows, round skulls would be found.
What?
Yeah. But that was repressed because Richard Atkinson didn't agree with that.
Okay.
So because he was the professor of the time and very widely respected, he was on TV. He was the first person that did an archaeological dig on TV. He was widely respected. If he didn't agree with something, him and Stuart Piggott, it would be put on a back burner and filed away in a museum and not really looked at again. So because these people had a great influence on British archaeology, I can't overemphasize the impact that they had. For example, Stuart Piggott, who worked alongside Richard Atkinson, said about Woodhenge, which is a six concentric circles of wood that's located close to the Stonehenge monument itself. He said, oh, he liked churches, so he put a roof on it. So a lot of see on the internet have a roof on it. But water and fire is easy to find by archaeologists. If that did have a roof, you'd have water running off the roof and you'd find it in the ground. He didn't find that. But he still put a roof on that. And that is, most modern day archaeologists disagree with Stuart Piggott. But you will still find that on the internet because that was what he thought. So they didn't agree with the elongated skulls. They didn't fit into their model. So it was ignored. When I reevaluated all the old archaeological reports, it was clear that they did have longer skulls. Not like the really cone heads of Paracas, for example.
Or the ones that Brian Forster has been finding in Peru.
Yeah, exactly. They're not that exaggerated. You know, they're not that looking. But still, they were much, much longer.
And are we talking about two different species, two different races, two different what?
That's a really interesting question, and which unfortunately I can't answer 100%, because the skulls that I went to view in a top university in the UK had been contaminated. It'd been touched so many times, it'd been broken in transit, it'd been glued together, basically. The early archaeologists, you know, weren't that careful.
Well, it was smash and grab, basically.
Yes. So they were taken out of the ground.
So we can't get DNA.
You can't get DNA on some of the skulls. But it is such an effort. I mean, that took me 6 months to trace one skull by being put off from one department to another department to another department. I was put on a merry-go-round. But I'm determined.
Persistent,
and,
yes.
And I'm
Are you a Taurus?
No, I have my moon in Taurus,
okay.
But I'm Pisces.
Ah.
But nonetheless, I wanted to look at that skull because a modern day archaeologist from picture number one, Bellis Knapp, Longbarrow in Gloucestershire, an anomaly was found right in the kind of brick wall that you see on the left hand side of that picture. Was found a skull with an elongated skull next to a round skull, and both of them came out as if we're to believe carbon dating, which may or may not be the truth, but it seemed that they were placed in there at the same time. They were contemporary people.
Well, remember, the carbon dating absolute is subject to weird questions now because of the background energy fluctuations.
Yeah.
But the relative dating should be accurate. So if they're both found in the same place and they both date the same age, whatever the age is, it's pretty sure they are contemporaneous, which means we have two separate species, hominid species, intelligent architects of these ancient structures living side by side in some relationship?
Exactly. That was found in the year 2000.
Wow.
And it was found that was contemporary because it was believed by some archaeologists in the UK that the ancient Britons had longer skulls, and hence long barrows, long skulls, elongated monuments. And I matched the two because they built that. Then in the Stonehenge area, you have a lot of long barrows on Salisbury Plain. And Salisbury Plain is run and managed by the MOD military. Yeah?
Okay, I have a question here. In fact, if we really probably don't have time this evening on your first visit to the other side of midnight for calls because there's too much left to go through. But if I don't ask this question from M, I will probably be disowned. She wants to know about time slips and manifestations in ancient sites. In other words, if we're dealing with all these hyperdimensional energies and enhancement and alignment and reinforcement, they were doing something. Have you ever heard of or have you ever experienced weird manifestations of the energy just as a person?
I personally have, but going back to the 1970s and the 1980s with the Dragon Project run by Dr. John Steele and Paul Devereux. I mentioned Paul Devereux's name earlier, and Rodney Hale. They got a team of scientists together, as well as sensitives, dowsers and psychics and Wiccans.
And they really did it right.
Yeah, left and right brain approach, we could say, yeah. And they noticed that on the road outside of the Rollright stone circle that I mentioned, the stone circle that retains its circular shape and behaves like a stone circle proper, that the when the scientists were having their sandwiches and, you know, drinking from their flasks, that every now and again, it was almost like a time slip was happening, where one scientist noticed that suddenly an old-fashioned gypsy caravan was approaching the car that they were sat in, and then they looked again and it disappeared. Another scientist saw this massive black dog appear. I mean, a very, very not a normal sized dog.
Like a dire wolf, maybe?
Yep, starting to pace around the car. So the road outside of the Rollright has been nicknamed by the Dragon Project team, Spook Road. Because along Spook Road, strange things will happen. Strange things will manifest, appear, disappear. It will make you feel that, you know, that your own consciousness has changed in some way. So that's the road right outside of that ancient site.
So this was only, sorry again, this was only because they were sitting there observing as part of this project.
They were taking time out on the lay-by by the road.
But they weren't doing anything with the site. They were just having lunch. Okay. Has anybody tried in an experimental situation to actually put energy into an ancient circle or a barrel or whatever to observe what happens if you add to the energy?
Rodney Hale has been doing some experiments where, you know, if you get a group of people together, will their consciousness change anything from the background ionizing radiation? And this is what he found, and this is a quite a fun analogy, but just goes to show the ability of human consciousness. In England, you have a lot of soccer fans. Yep.
Of course.
And if England scores a goal, there is raptures. You have people in inns and pubs and in their homes all kind of cheering. And Rodney had the insight to test the background ionizing radiation of when, before England scored a goal, he set a control. Yeah.
Let me assess this properly. In other words, you have people all over England celebrating when their teams win, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
this guy is at an ancient site with none of the fans, none of the crowd, just himself measuring. And he's measuring before and after a big game when everybody in England's going to erupt depending upon which team wins.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Just so we get that clear, because this is important.
Yes, yes. Thank you for that clarification. And what he noticed was at the moment England scored the goal, it was anticipated that they would probably do quite well in that match, for example, the background radiation dipped down.
What?
It dipped down through England scoring a goal, which sounds, you know, that shouldn't happen.
Oh, it's totally counterintuitive.
Exactly. That's the work of Rodney Hale. He also noticed, I mean, I'm sure that American listeners would have all heard of Lady Diana Spencer.
Just a tad, yes.
Yeah. And Rodney wanted to know the effect of not just cheering, but what about the sadness of a nation?
Oh.
Yeah. She was really loved here. Whether you're a royalist or not over here, she was admired. Yeah.
Of course.
And, you know, at the...
Americans have this weird affinity for British royalty. I don't get it, but my God, we do. Go ahead.
I'm English and I don't get it, Richard. We're on the same page. But nonetheless, there were times when you could make tributes to Diana and you'd take flowers there. And there was a national mourning point, right, you know, where people were mourning her. And he noticed changes again to the background ionizing radiation levels, you know, when the nation mourned as well as when they cheered. So it just goes to show that...
But what happened? Did the radiation increase or decrease?
I would have to look to the report of that to be 100% truthful. I can't remember that one.
Oh my gosh! Let's try to find that, because this mirrors the work of an American project called the Consciousness Project, with Dean Radin, and he's using little random number generators hooked to a computer network, and he's found he looked at the same thing. He looked at Diana's death. He looked at 9/11. And there's bizarre spikes in the randomness, the increased randomness when things are not happening that are interesting. And then when something important happens, the eggs go coherent. The randomness goes down, and the coherence, meaning the cohesiveness of the energy, the directedness, the orderliness of the energy, increased during these moments of global consciousness stress.
Yes, I mean, exactly so. So, you know, the way we interact with our environment will have an impact on the environment. And that's really...
Go ahead.
That's really interesting when you look at a lot of people used to gather at Avebury Henge. You know, it's been pointed out by archaeologists like Aubrey Burr. You could fit thousands of people into Avebury, not necessarily at Stonehenge, but you certainly could at the large henge monuments like Avebury Henge and Stanton Drew.
But what if the people in the monument, inside the henge, are only, and my audience will be familiar with this term, the pilot wave for thousands and thousands gathered on the plains around it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly so. So, you know, you have the ability to interact with your environment with focused thought into the energy field. And also we must remember that beneath most ancient sites across Europe, from Malta to Stonehenge to Sardinia, for example, you have a vast amount of underground water, and all homeopaths will inform us that water has memory.
Absolutely. It basically holds the torsion field. Okay, we don't have a lot of time left. I want to have time to go through the Avebury experience and your esoteric college, so if people want to get hold of you and get into this and understand that they can do it, they can get involved.
Exactly. I mean, I teach dowsing to decode your house as well as ancient sites. And you can go to the avebryexperience.co.uk and have a look around the website. I also do online dowsing courses with Skype as well to give personal tuition in dowsing and astrology and tarot. And that's esotericcollege.com.
So yeah, those links are both on your bio on the go to Radio with Pictures, click on that, and you'll get to Maria's page tonight and scroll down past all the interesting images, and there are these two links, the Avebury Experience and Esoteric College. So I mean, to me, this says that maybe standard archaeology has been looking at these sites, these monuments, in a totally wrong way, in that they were designed to change and maybe uplift mass consciousness among a people that needed that technology to survive and prevail.
Yes, and I agree, and I think it was an interaction. That's very, 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 very important. But what I did notice, I mean, I've been going to Stonehenge for many, many years, like half my life. I've been going to Stonehenge. And in 2010, I noticed something. The stones were coming, they were either being recharged up by naturally through some longer cycle that I don't understand, but nonetheless, the stones were becoming more highly charged. The closer you got to them, you could feel its energy field compared to, say, like 5 years ago or 10 years ago. From that moment, Richard, English Heritage, who managed the monument, came out with a policy: nobody, not even on private access, can touch the stones anymore.
Well, that seems kind of non-coincidental. In other words, they know what's going on and they want to keep people from getting what these things really were for.
I think, you know, you join your own dots, you know, but...
Very diplomatic, dear. Very diplomatic.
But nonetheless, you know, it is a very, very, very powerful place, and I think it is still coming into its power.
Well, what's so weird is that when Robin and I were there in the rain with these guards with their slickers, because they had the raincoats and we didn't, and they saw the readings I was getting. Incredible. Something, it was almost like something was buried under Stonehenge, under the center. And I was getting at certain angles the kind of offshoot energies. They would not let me in the rain just at closing time when they close everything down and they spiff it up for the private groups. They wouldn't let me walk across that little rope, move 20 feet into the center of the circle, and measure there. It was like somehow they had been told, never let anybody with scientific equipment get anywhere near this place.
Yes, it is like that. I've experienced that myself at Stonehenge. Round about sort of 2200 BC, right at the center of Stonehenge, and this is quite intriguing because, again, it doesn't fit into an archaeological model, a large square, rectangular, very deep trench was made, enough for you to lie down in.
Oh?
Mm. Oh. And... So again, anything that doesn't fit into the model of Stonehenge, it gets ignored, and you have to look for the archaeological reports to find out, you know, what really happened at Stonehenge. And, you know, the encodements there are fantastic. The blue stone circle is 79 feet, 20 inches in diameter across. And it was like John Michel pointed out in his book that you mentioned, New View of Atlantis, that if you multiply that by 100, you get 7,920 feet, the diameter of the Earth. So Stonehenge encodes, you know, these significant numbers of the diameter of the Earth. It's a very sophisticated monument.
Well, Carl Munk has found, again in the work that I'm going to find and send to you, that these sacred sites all over the world, starting with Stonehenge, he started decoding Stonehenge, he finds that they are related mathematically and geodetically to other sites. That somehow they know the presence and the location of these other sites halfway around the world, which of course goes to the idea that we're looking at things that are much, much older, from a previous epoch of much higher knowledge, yes, of these energies, and we've been looking at degradation ever since.
I agree. When you start to see the similarities in terms of the esoteric design canons with the earth energies, the lays, the placements, and the similarities that everything shares points to a common source of knowledge that was, yep, you know, awareness,
yes,
in the ancient world. And let's face it, you know, around about the time, whether it was 10,000 BC or 3,000 BC, the global people were galvanized to mark these places on Earth through a massive monumental building program.
Which indicates there's a time situation where the physics changes at certain times and you want to get ready for those times. And the good news is one of those times in our calculations is 2016, 2017. So if we could get over there in the next few months and measure compared to 2010, you said there was a bump in the energies.
Yes.
I think that English Heritage, if in fact they are trying to keep this side of their field quiet, secret, they're not going to have much luck, because you won't have to touch the stones. They will resonate and vibrate and amplify a background rising and will manifest in very intriguing ways. So more gypsy carts and more weird dire wolves may be appearing in other places all around England.
I'll be there, Richard.
Well, I want to thank my guests tonight, because we're unfortunately at the end of the show. 2 hours goes by so quickly when you're getting into this stuff. Maria Wheatley, I want you to go and check out her web links and her sites and her esoteric college and something that's really interesting called the Avery School of Esoteric Studies. This has been one heck of an evening. I thank you so much, Maria. Please come back.
Thank you, Richard. I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Okay. And until tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, as we say. Even on the other side of midnight, we'll see you tomorrow. Until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.